Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi. I'm Dexter Fergie, and you're listening to New Books in History. Today I'll be speaking with Diana Lemberg about her exciting new book called Barriers Down: How American Power and Free Flow Policies Shaped Global Media. It was published last year by Columbia University Press. Lemberg traces the history of the free flow of information, an idea that has guided America's relations with the rest of the world since World War II. It's also an idea that seems benign, perhaps even difficult to disagree with. I mean, who could possibly oppose the freedom of information? But as Lemberg shows, the idea certainly wasn't always benign, and throughout the latter half of the 20th century, many stood against it. Lemberg examines how American businessmen, statesmen, and social scientists sought to tear down barriers to transnational flows of information, and in the process, maximize the spread of American content overseas. As Hollywood films and American news inundated the rest of the world, foreign governments saw this as a loss of sovereignty and fought back. This book should be read by anyone with an interest in U.S. foreign relations, communication studies, and how ideas shape international norms. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'm speaking with Diana Lemberg about her new book, Barriers Down: How American Power and Free Flow Policies Shaped Global Media. Thanks for being on the show, Diana.
Thanks so much, Dexter, for having me.
Yeah, your book packs a lot of punch in its 200 or so pages, so we're going to have a lot to discuss. But I want to begin with how you even became a historian. What pulled you to doing a PhD in history in the first place?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I had always loved libraries and archives. Something about the smell, the dusty smell of the paper, to be honest. And my first job was actually in a library. I was a shelver. So I think it was really a love of archival research combined with a kind of growing sense that I had in high school and especially in college that history was a really powerful way of understanding the world, like understanding how we got into our current political and economic sort of situation. It was that combination, the analytical power of history plus my sort of eccentric love of archives.
Mm-hmm. Well, you did end up going to a university with an exceptionally beautiful library. So I don't know if that featured into your deliberations and choosing the program, but, you know, the Yale Library is famous for its beauty.
Yeah, they were renovating it for part of my time there, but I did get to enjoy like the stained glass windows and the kind of cathedral-like atmosphere for part of the time. So
good. Good. This book began as a dissertation when you were a student at Yale. And it's also a dissertation that I actually read when I began my own PhD. So can you just share with listeners how you envisioned the project when you began your dissertation and how you turned it into a book?
That's a good question. I think I kind of started the project with a curiosity about the idea of like the free flow of information. It just seemed pervasive, not only in some of the sources I was reading in some of my early graduate seminars on like US international history, but also in secondary literature. I saw that it was deployed sort of without analysis. And of course, as historians, we often you know, make use of concepts in that way to sort of frame phenomena in the past analytically in ways that our subjects wouldn't have used. But I think I became sort of curious about why this concept of freely flowing information was so pervasive and when it, you know, when it really sort of came to be. So the project kind of started with that, I don't know, fixation of mine. And when I initially began in grad school, I was sort of looking at it from a transatlantic perspective. This was true in the dissertation because a lot of my archives were European archives. And then the project of turning into a book was somewhat contingent, as I think it is for most people, on sort of my like professional path after grad school. I sort of had done a lot of research in Europe. Then I came back to the US and I was on the market for a year. And very much by fluke, I got this job in Hong Kong. And so I sort of had to hurry up and finish the dissertation really pretty quickly without doing some of the research that I wanted to do in the United States. So I was lucky in that the Hong Kong has pretty generous research funding for faculty and especially junior faculty. And I was able to like go back to the US and do archival research for a semester to kind of fill in the book. Or to turn it into a book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that archival depth it's really apparent in the book itself. So I'm glad that you were able to take that time to do that research. So you begin the book with a discussion of one of your actors, Kent Cooper, and his mm-hmm. philosophy of the free flow of information. He was one of the first to really articulate this idea. So I think he'd be a really good person for us to start our conversation with and to kind of get into the broader themes of your book. So who was Kent Cooper? What were his concerns about information barriers? And what did he mean by free flow of information?
Yeah, he's a great person to start with. Kent Cooper was a journalist and a news agency man who was head of the Associated Press in sort of the early to mid 20th century, sort of the interwar period through the 1940s. And Cooper had been, by the 1940s, which is sort of when the book picks up, Kent Cooper had been sort of preoccupied by a problem affecting American news agencies trying to operate overseas, which was that news agencies in the 20th century could only sort of distribute their news in certain markets. There was an industry-wide cartel led by Reuters, the British agency. Havas, the French agency, also participated. And so did the Associated Press, which Cooper was head of. And so while the AP was participating in the cartel, at the same time, Cooper was sort of chafing at this like restriction of his potential market. And he makes a fuss about this sort of continuously in the interwar period. And then the Second World War comes and it's like this opportunity for Kent Cooper, who sees the news cartels as essentially having prevented people in Germany from gaining access to good information. They could only access by 1940 Nazi propaganda. That's what had driven them sort of into the war. And so this was Kent Cooper's somewhat strange explanation for at least part of the start of the Second World War, strange to our ears, I suppose. And so he pushed for the U.S. or the policy community in the United States to take up the banner of the free flow of information or freedom of information sort of after the Second World War as a matter of national policy. And even though Ken Cooper was basically a libertarian, he opposed government involvement in the news in most cases. He was all about free markets, but he did support a U.S. commitment to freedom of information, for instance, in the international forums that were developing in the 1940s, like the UN.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, the free flow of information sounds good. You know, how can you disagree with it? But it turns out that the meanings that people invested with really made this idea quite contentious. You know, Kent Cooper, as you are explaining, he represents a really distinctly American perspective. But I'm curious what non-Americans approach the question of the free flow of information in this time period.
Yeah, that's a good question. So Cooper was in favor of sort of stripping away regulations that prevented American news people from accessing foreign markets. And in this quest, he was sort of joined by people in the film industry and radio who wanted access to foreign markets, particularly the film industry. And so when the United States sort of starts to pursue these aims after the war, they run into any number of people who are saying, wait, freedom of information is not necessarily just about, you know, stripping away your barriers to market access. One of the opponents of U.S. policies was a guy named John Grierson, who had a very different vision of sort of the possibilities of media. He was a Scottish filmmaker, film producer. He's actually very well known in sort of film studies for being an early theorist of documentary film. He had spent the war in Canada, as you probably know. And he was working for the Canadian government, helping to organize wartime information efforts. And Grierson, he also was involved in this in sort of American discussions of press freedom at the time. And he becomes this big critic of American power in the post-war world. He says basically, you know, the U.S. is consuming most of the newsprint in the world at a moment right after the war when a lot of countries couldn't get newsprint. They didn't have the dollars to import newsprint. And Grierson says, look, if people, you know, don't have newspapers to read because all the newspapers have closed because there's no newsprint, then what kind of freedom of information is that if the United States is consuming so much of the world's newsprint? So there were these alternative visions of information freedoms. Grierson's was more sort of materialist, I would say. Yeah, and he actually gets red-baited for it. So the American kind of vision for it is not the only game in town. Mm-hmm.
I was really struck by your discussions of Grierson and others, how just in this post-war moment, this time when, the Americans like Cooper and others are articulating the free flow of information, there's this material obstacle, namely just the lack of newsprint in Europe and elsewhere, that actually, as you put it, made this flow into a trickle. what was a barrier for the Europeans was not seen as such for the Americans. And you actually you have this this fact, this statistic from UNESCO that really blew me away, which is in 1950, Americans were consuming 56% of the world's newsprint, whereas Europeans were consuming something like 22%. And those numbers are staggering.
Yeah, that was one of those archival kind of discoveries that I made. That I just sort of, the newsprint crisis in Europe was so little discussed in, I guess, especially in Americanist literature, even though there's a big literature on sort of the Marshall Plan and the need for aid. This struck me, this newsprint crisis, which lasted for, you know, many years, like just like rationing of food in Europe lasted for many years after the war was over. Newsprint was scarce sort of into the early 50s, and it was rationed in various places. And so I felt like it was one of those kind of stories that I sort of had to tell in the book, because it really did shed light on the ways, you know, freedom of information can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
Mm-hmm. So an important assumption in your book is that the concept of information is historical. Can you say something about what information meant to people before the time period that you're looking at, and how the concept was changing in the 1940s?
So information, it's one of those concepts that seems self-evident to us today. It refers, you know, you can sort of use it as an abstract term to refer to any sort of media, whether it be film, television, print media. You can refer it to whatever you've gleaned from those different kinds of media. But this usage is actually fairly recent. The linguist Jeff Nunberg has written about how information used to have a much more sort of normative connotation. Like there's a quote from this great quote that he has from, I think it's from a Jane Austen novel, I forget which one, where a character is calling someone a man of information. And the character doesn't mean that the person, you know, has a lot of social media accounts. the meaning is that this is a person who is sort of learned or has been instructed in, you know, the liberal arts, something like that. And it's really only in the early to mid 20th century that we see a shift towards a more sort of content neutral understanding of information, and an understanding that, you know, not only print media contains information, but that other media such as film and radio, later on television and digital media, also contain information. This shift is, I think it's, there are a couple of factors behind it. One is this nascent civil liberties movement in the US, which slowly sort of starts to make the argument that other media besides print media deserve First Amendment protections because these media also transmit information. And here their contribution in the war effort, like the contribution of Hollywood and the radio industry, is crucial, because then those industries themselves can make the argument, well, look, we, you know, made these great war films. We deserve to be considered informational media, not just entertainment. Because at that time they didn't have, you know, film didn't have First Amendment protections. So that's one factor behind this transformation. The second is technological. It relates to developments that were happening in the 40s in sort of engineering and cryptography. The mathematician Claude Shannon was very influential in developing what became known as the mathematical theory of communication, in which he basically defines information in terms of bits, in terms that like computer scientists would recognize today. And so Shannon, you know, he says that he doesn't intend his theory to be a statement about content or messages, but his ideas about information quickly get taken up in the social sciences and sort of spread after after his work is declassified in the late 40s and published. And so these changes are sort of what bring about the contemporary sense of information that we have today, which is broad, it's not medium specific. And in the computer science sense, at least, it's purely quantitative. It's a matter of bits, or it can be purely quantitative.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's so fascinating because it really, I mean, as you you know, put it, information is this almost self-evident concept. You know, as you show and as other historians are starting to show, it really does have a history. You know, this concept was historically produced. So just going forward a little bit, the way I read your book is a lot, it's about how actors in the US and in Europe conceptualize barriers to information. And so sometimes in the case of, you know, like the newsprint shortage, Europeans see this as a barrier, whereas Americans don't. But then the next barrier that you take your readers through is the barrier of language, and more specifically, multilingualism and you know, the absence of a universal global language. Can you talk about efforts to rectify this, you know, this like quote unquote problem in the post-war period?
Yeah, absolutely. So, The term language barrier actually becomes popularized in the post-war era for exactly the reasons that your air quotes suggest, in that that language differences become sort of turn into language barriers once Americans start taking an interest in distant places in, you know, Asia and Africa, where they've sort of never had a presence before. So in terms of American interest in spreading the English language as a kind of global lingua franca, you know, there's a prehistory to this in American efforts in Puerto Rico and the Philippines to make English into like a language that, you know, everyone had English classes, to make it the language of education in these colonies, or in the case of Puerto Rico territory. But these efforts really gain steam after the Second World War, partly because of the push to decolonize, or the wave of decolonization that sort of sweeps across Asia and then Africa in the 50s and 60s. Suddenly, the U.S. sees a lot of opportunity in these places to spread its influence. It's also really afraid of Soviet influence. And so this in part explains, growing American interest in spreading English, and English teaching gets institutionalized like in a whole host of U.S. government agencies USIA, USAID, Peace Corps, Fulbright, as well as some of the big private foundations. Rockefeller and Ford are both interested in language teaching overseas. And another sort of piece of this growing American interest in global English is, of course, like development, the idea of development aid, and the idea that, you know, Indonesia or Vietnam, they need American scientific and technical expertise to modernize. Yet, you know, if you have people who you can't communicate with, you can't share scientific information with, that's going to be a big problem. And so that is sort of part and parcel of these efforts by USAID agencies to spread English.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that was really compelling, sort of the role of development as sort of a vehicle for expanding English. You have an amazing quote from a USAID report in 1967, which says that English was the common instrument best suited to transferring needed knowledge, skills, and activities to the third world. And so here you can see that, you know, like English was becoming the language of development.
Yeah, absolutely. And this really, you know, concerned some of the, some other countries, including France, who could, you know, France, for instance, could see its, or was afraid that its influence was going to, its cultural influence was going to slip away in its former colonies. So it, you know, it's pushing to spread French in a kind of parallel Francophone universe with some success, although, you know, clearly the sheer power of the U.S. economy and the U.S. government backing the promotion of English and development are, I think, part of why, you know, we can go to other countries and speak English pretty easily today.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So moving on to the next chapter, which deals with development a bit more specifically. So, you know, development has been a rich subject of study in recent years for historians, but you reframe its history in terms of information, and you show how the concept of development had these inbuilt assumptions about information. For example, you know, in regards to, you know, communication technologies, literacy, you know, access to information. Can you talk about these connections between development and information? And it might be a good place to start with the really fascinating UNESCO film, Television Comes to the Land.
Well, I think it's funny because I think that in the historiography of development, which is really rich at this point, it's a little bit like set apart from the work of media studies scholars on development who have sort of addressed the role of information and development. I'm thinking of like Emil McEnany, for instance. But yeah, I was interested in the role of media information, especially because it plays such a central part of some of the early like modernization texts, like Daniel Lerner's Passing of Traditional Society, which is basically all about the impact of media in Turkey to like modernize people's attitudes. So the interesting thing about that book, or one of the interesting things I think, was this connection between like, you know, individual experience and consumption of media and these really large scale processes that the U.S. government wanted to pursue in its global struggle for hegemony with the Soviet Union. You know, Lerner was basically saying, give people more newspapers, more radio stations, and they're gonna modernize themselves. And that's what this film, Television Comes to the World, which UNESCO produced in, I think it was the late 50s, early 60s. That film is also sort of saying the same thing, that, you know, just give people this window onto the world. In the case of the film, it was television, and they're going to, you know, see how people live in cities. They're going to see modern appliances, and they're going to want, that's going to give them the incentive to try to modernize themselves. So, so I think what part of what was interesting to me was in looking at this was what consensus existed in internationally about these issues. You had buy-in not only from U.S. experts, but from European experts who were, you know, who wanted their countries to sort of maintain economic and cultural influence, even when their empires, their formal political control was crumbling. And then, of course, in the developing world, development brought the promise of aid. And so, you know, many, at least in the early 60s, many developing world elites were enthusiastic about development aid. So that was one of the things, that moment of consensus in kind of the early 60s that I found that I wanted to explore more.
Like what that chapter reveals to me is that like modernization is all about information and access to information and, you know, communication technologies and, going through, these like really big thinkers or representative thinkers such as Daniel Lerner, that's really evident. I was really interested in your information take on development. So the next stage of your book, or the next chapter of your book, is about communication satellites. And so they play a really big role in the history of the free flow of information. They were at first a US-driven development. So what did American policymakers and business elites hope to accomplish with satellites? And what did the rest of the world think of these satellites?
So when early satellite technology was first develop early communication satellite technology in the early 1960s, the U.S. quickly became the preeminent power in this technology. The Soviet Union, of course, also had satellites. It had launched the first satellite with Sputnik in 1957. But the U.S. quickly sort of becomes dominant in communication satellite technology. And for U.S. policymakers, you know, this is very tantalizing because communication satellites had the capacity to not only to sort of beam signal around the world, they also had much greater channel capacity than existing cables, undersea cables. And so, you know, the U.S. sort of policy elite community, both in government and adjacent to government, were really excited about this. They thought it would be a way to encourage people to speak English. They thought it would be a way to sell their television programming overseas. There was just a lot of excitement. But for the rest of the world, this picture was less appealing, because other countries couldn't build or launch their own satellites for some time. And the launcher for communication satellites was a particular problem. Through the 1960s, you know, no country in Europe could launch its own satellites. And so, you know, even for the U.S., the United States' closest allies in Western Europe, they were alarmed by U.S. dominance. And so they start to sort of, you know, complain that the U.S. is basically controls this technology more than it should. So there's that piece. And there was an international sort of push for regulation that I talk about in the book. And a second part of the international response is the will to have their own satellites, to have regional satellite systems. You know, so you'd have France and Germany collaborating to build a Franco-German satellite that could sort of compete with U.S. satellites on a regional level eventually. And so, you know, they don't want to be left behind by U.S. technological prowess. That was a big fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And can you say a bit more about the question of sovereignty in satellites? Because I mean, that's a really fascinating bit to this chapter. What satellites really meant for sovereignty and more specifically information sovereignty.
Yeah, sure. And I should say too, I skipped this point a second ago, but for U.S. policymakers, they saw satellite transmission as a way of like opening up information flows. And they increasingly in the 60s and especially in the 70s, they begin to say, you know, you shouldn't regulate the transmission of the information from satellites between countries. And so for the rest of the world, this doesn't really seem like free flow. It seems like a threat to their sovereignty. It's difficult to remember, but, you know, through the 1960s, most countries had public television broadcasting, and outside the Western Hemisphere, even Britain had a broadcasting system in the BBC that was sort of much more governmentally managed and subsidized. and so you know, they're afraid of they're afraid that satellites, particularly satellites that had the capacity to beam signal directly into homes, just sort of on the horizon in the 60s and 70s, they see that as a threat to their sovereignty, a threat to their ability to kind of manage the information that their citizens are consuming on television and otherwise. The U.S. gets some pushback for its interest in satellite broadcasting, especially its interest in direct satellite broadcasting. Again, those were the satellites that would be able to beam signal directly to individual users with dishes, bypassing like national communications infrastructure that earlier generations of satellite had used. So the U.S. gets some pushback about this, and instead of conceding to international calls for regulation, it basically decides that what needs to happen is that regulation itself needs to be sort of peeled back internationally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's a really interesting story. And, you know, just to I'll just mention here that I'm also working on this question. So I found this chapter exceptionally useful for my own self-interest. So just like moving on to the 1970s, you track a really interesting shift in beliefs among social scientists, American social scientists, from sort of this like state-powered modernization, which we were talking about your development chapter, to a belief in a technology-powered modernization. And there's one individual in particular, Itiel de Solapool. Am I pronouncing his name correctly?
Oh gosh, you know, I admit the first name. I'm not sure, okay. But we can just call him de Solapool.
De Solapool, perfect. So this individual embodies this shift. Can you just share with listeners who de Solapool was, how his thinking changed, and how he kind of represented the zeitgeist of American social science in this period?
Yeah, sure. He was a fascinating and kind of slippery character who's sort of best known for two things. The first is being a real war hawk in Vietnam in the 60s, a real advocate for the use of social science research for government and especially military purposes. Joy Road has written about this phase of de Solapool's career. And secondly, in the 1970s and early 1980s, he sort of changes tack and he becomes a real advocate for communications deregulation and an advocate for unregulated information flows, both domestically and also abroad. So we see this shift, like you said, from a de Sola Pool being kind of conventional supporter of government-led modernization to this this person who really was a backer of like market power as the engine of progress. And I look especially in the book at this article he wrote in the late 70s that talks about actually television in Vietnam. Again, he was like intimately involved with the American war effort in Vietnam. And he says something interesting about television there. He says, you know, what television in Vietnam revealed to us is that there was this audience that was sort of untapped, that was hungry for American and Western programming. There was essentially unmet demand. I think he uses the phrase unmet demand. So he basically is treating television in Vietnam as a kind of market. Mm-hmm. And an illustration of why, unregulated information flows are a good thing. But what he doesn't mention in this article is that the quote unquote market in Vietnam for television was totally created by U.S. government and military spending. Television was sort of forcibly introduced in Vietnam by the U.S. military in the sort of 66 or 67. Its initial broadcasts happen from planes because the transmitters weren't ready when they wanted to introduce it from Defense Department planes. So it's completely militarized and in no sense like a free market. And yet that's how de Sola Pool is treating it. So by the 1980s, he writes this pretty famous book called Technologies of Freedom that is primarily oriented towards domestic deregulation. De Sola Pool is particularly concerned about regulation of new digital technologies that are coming into being at that time in the early 1980s. But the book also has implications for international communications in that he sort of treats most regulations on communications as a threat to the First Amendment. And that includes regulations by foreign countries to stop satellite broadcasting. So, and this book is like kind of it's part of the zeitgeist, as you said, the word is apt, in the early 1980s as Ronald Reagan is coming to power and is, sort of dismantling regulation at the FCC, Federal Communications Commission. And it's really a kind of remarkable pivot that de Sola Pool makes from modernization to sort of technologically driven information flows. But it's one that's sort of representative of like a broader political shift.
Mm-hmm. Great. And so as we're approaching the end of your book, I just have a couple more questions. The first is, having gone through all of this history, how should we think about the relationship between U.S. power and information?
Well, I think in part, the book is telling, almost telling the story of how we got to the 2016 election or the situation in 2016 where information flows from overseas actually impacted the U.S. election, through social media, through sort of cyber warfare by the Russian government, through teenagers in places like Macedonia discovering that fake news is profitable and posting it on social media. So in one sense, the book is telling the prehistory of that, because these policies that the U.S. pursues to increase global information flows, to deregulate them, are, you know, they're sort of opposed by a lot of people in a lot of different places in the mid to late 20th century, who understand that information can be a threat to things like sovereignty, election security. And the U.S., you know, the U.S. government is very involved in disrupting other countries' sovereignty when it wants to during the Cold War. So 2016 kind of marks the moment when this reality comes home to roost in the United States, where the U.S. is experiencing what a lot of other countries have experienced in the preceding decades. However, I do think, you know, that U.S. power can be used in ways that might support civil liberties abroad. You know, the recent Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, which ensured that the U.S. was going to monitor civil liberties in Hong Kong, among other things. I think that the post 45 period is when the U.S. kind of becomes interested in such issues. So the record is sort of ambiguous in that regard.
Well, you managed to answer my second question with that answer. So we'll leave our conversation about the book there. We always conclude our interviews, though, with the question, but what you're working on right now?
So I've got a second project that I've started. It kind of takes off from the book in that it's about language and language training. And I'm looking at how the U.S. government became involved in language training, especially after or during World War II, because there were all these strategic languages that it didn't have many people who spoke or understood. And so it got involved in this massive effort to train soldiers in Japanese, for instance, later Russian. And then these sort of defense investments filter into the civilian sector after the war. So that's the current project, sort of on applied linguistics and U.S. power.
That sounds really interesting, and I look forward to reading it. Again, I want to thank you so much for being on the show, Diana. It was a real pleasure to discuss your book.
Thanks so much, Dexter. It was really great to have this opportunity to talk about the book with you.
Great. And I've been speaking with Diana Lemberg about her book, Barriers Down: How American Power and Free Flow Policies Shape Global Media. And you've been listening to New Books in History.